Okay, we're in Bereishis Perek Gimel.
When did they plant that piece here?
Please you sit down.
See if they have enough money.
Okay.
Close the door in the back.
Perek Gimel. Okay. In previous years, we've been studying books, characters, topics. So we have... What could we go wrong if our topic is Hashem? Mm-hmm. God. Okay, our topic for today, as we move on, is how certain theories of ancient man and their gods and what is created and what the way people see and understand deities, how the Torah in its depictions and its stories debunk these theories. Okay? According to ancient Babylonian myth, the earth came to be because Marduk and Tiamat had a war, and the result of that war was various body parts that get flung across the cosmos and they become planets. And right, so I'm not afraid to say that the Ruach Elokim Rachefes al Pnei Tehom, that the Torah is purposely using a word that sounds like the goddess that actually loses this battle, that the Torah is sort of mocking this. Possibly even the word Tohu. Sadia Gaon says the word Tohu is related to the word Tehom. That your God is Tohu. Your God is your descriptions of all this came to be is nonsense. Of course, this assumes, and I have no problem assuming this, that the Israelites receiving the Torah and reading this the first time were well aware of these myths. Just as much as most people around this table can tell me the name of a Disney character that's an elephant that flies. Okay? So, if you, that the Israelites were aware of, the Israelites were aware of some of these ancient myths and stories, and were they influenced by them? Look, I see in Sefer Shoftim, the Israelites were influenced by Canaanite practice and possibly literature and lore as well. So the Torah purposely debunks these known theories. Of course, I'm taking quite a liberty here to say that they knew this. Now, don't mind, I'll be saying that all year. I'll be saying it all year, that the Israelites knew that cooking milk and meat together involved a pagan ritual. They knew it. They were aware of it. The Torah is warning them about it. All right. The Rambam says this all over the Morei Nebuchim. What I just described in the last 3 minutes may be an all-encompassing approach that the Rambam in the Morei Nebuchim takes to Korbanos. In the beginning of Vayikra, the Rambam says that the reason why we don't bring up honey and yeast in our sacrifices is because honey and yeast was very popular in all ancient Near Eastern sacrificial orders. Master tasted it, right? So they loved honey and yeast. So that's enough to make us hate it. The Rambam goes one step further. The Rambam says the reason why we always have salt on our karban is because they hated salt. So that's one step too far. Ramban says, I'm willing to accept the first. This one, this is crazy. There are independent reasons why we should have salt on the Mizbeach, irrespective of what they hate. So because they hate it, now we love it? I understand because they love it, we may hate it. Because some of what they love involves a lot of bad stuff, let's put it that way for now. Right? It's bad philosophies about imposing and inflicting will on other people and forcing the gods into certain behavior and things like that. So I don't want you to have any such notions. So some of the mitzvahs of the Torah dispel these notions. Look, I'm saying some specific things. This is abundantly clear in general. The Torah says, like the deeds of the Egyptians where you left, and like the deeds of the Canaanites where you're going to, don't follow their tachsisei kedusha and their nonsense. They believe in nonsensical things. They believe in irrational things. They have superstitions, and I don't want you being taken up by these superstitions. We will spend quite a bit of time on the occult. The occult is something not just powerful in Egypt, but all over the ancient world. It was very powerful in Bavel, where we were taken into Golus. Yirmiyahu deals with that in chapter 11 of his book. And we'll see that I won't always start every class with this kind of introduction, but let's see how this relates to the snake. Okay. Now, in ancient myths, a snake plays a very outsized role, greater than all other animals. The snake is called a seraph. It has superhuman powers, right? And there's also what pervades ancient Near Eastern myths and has made its way into many, many current nations, is some kind of sea creature. It's dafka, a sea creature. It's not a land creature, and it's not a bird, because then a man could possibly see one, right? But it always lurks underwater, and it has great power to even possibly defy God, right? And God will at one point finally defeat this power. It still lurks around the world. I just made reference just now, paraphrasing some psukim in Yeshayahu, some psukim in Tehillim, and especially psukim at the end of Eov, regarding this the Leviathan, Leviathan.
Not a good power.
So in the creation story, the snake is just another animal, and the Leviathan is just another creation. It's created. It's not.
I'm sorry, Rabbi. I hate to slow you.
No problem. Please.
In Genesis, he's represented as a snake that tempted Eve, no doubt.
So let's get into that. Okay, the snake is something that does not get to challenge God per se in God's power. The snake totally submits to God's power. If the snake challenges God, it's by trying to convince God's jewel crown achievement, mankind, to misbehave, if you will. What the snake actually did is now let's read a little bit here but in ancient cultures the snake represented the anti deity. Okay? Like some kind of being that can actually stand up to the deity. All right. In Eov, at the end of Eov, it's a sea creature. But in the beginning of Eov, there's something called Satan that does manage to, you know, sort of have God's, God's number. He's able to convince God of certain things that the reader has to wonder about. There are ancient cultures that have co-equal power gods, right? The Zoroastrians had a good god and a bad god. I think we spoke about that once before. And the Torah wants to debunk all of this immediately by putting the snake into a story where it does has some kind of agenda similar to what they have in these other stories. But the snake can't stand up to God. Okay? So let's read a little bit in Paragimel and see that, because I'm going to approach this from the standpoint of Ramban, mm-hmm. who understands man's continued role since the time of the end of chapter 3. Our job as human beings is to get back into that garden. Whatever we do, the job is to get back into the garden, which is why Yeshayahu, when describing the Yatzachot Migeza Yishai, it's the Torah in America for the eighth day of Pesach, outside of Israel, and in Israel, in some places, they read this Haftorah on Yom HaTzma'ut, if they do take out a special Torah reading in Haftorah, if it's not Monday or Thursday. So our job is to get back into the garden, because Yeshayahu amazingly describes this messianic revival as a time when children will play with snakes. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Let's see, we'll do all of this before the end of this presentation, because you have the whole Tanakh in front of us. So it says, We describe the snake as a room. It's more a room than all the other animals. I think we reached that part last time, right? Mm. It's more a room than all the other animals. Now, however we are to interpret what that means, right? Remember, the snake is just another one of the creations. It doesn't stand up against God. So what you have to understand that usually we do not apply the term arum to animals, right? No, maybe a fox. I don't know. The fox, arum. Fox is crafty. Yeah. It knows how to get a chicken, and it tricks the chicken. I don't know. But what animals are arum that I should call the snake the most arum of them all?
Doesn't it say aroar?
Aroom, in the beginning. In the beginning.
What verse are you on?
Beginning. Chapter 3, verse 1.
Oh, verse 1. Okay.
Okay. So it's with an ayin. Now, the Rav Yehuda Chosid says, it's so pashut. The pasuk right before this has the word aroom in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There it means naked.
Mm-hmm. Right? But it's aroom. Okay.
So here is how Rabbi Dachasid explains that the snake was more naked than all the other animals. And therefore, and Rabbi Dachasid goes along with Chazal's opinion that the snake had his eyes on Chava. Right? The snake was attracted to Chava. Now, any good parent who wants to punish a child with a proper punishment knows that you don't punish in anger, you don't punish in spite. A punishment, like any jail sentence or any such message, is supposed to be a learning experience. Mm. And therefore, a punishment ought to fit the crime. Mm. So if the snake's punishment is that I will cause enmity between the snake and the woman's descendant, right? What animal does a woman hate more than a snake? It must mean that a mouse?
Mouse.
Oh, mouse even more?
Delicious.
Okay, anyway. A snake, this is the snake's punishment, it must be that the snake wanted Chava. So that's Megoras Rasha, Itavosa. What punishment do you get? You don't get what you want, Korach. Now you're going to see the Kohanim are going to get even more than I was intending for them, right? When you do cause such harm to man, you won't get what you wanted, and she will hate you. Okay, so the Nachash was more arum. This is how Rabbi Chosid explains it, that the snake's skin was closest to man's skin. The other animals had fur. They had their skin was not soft or. Not that snake's skin could be scaly also a little bit, but it's mostly, compared to other animals, it's hard to say the snake was more crafty than all the other animals, but it is perhaps proper to say a snake had skin that was less hairy than all the other animals, and the way to say that is to say arum. Okay, let's move on from there. So that's Rabbi Yehuda Chosid, and he says that, so the snake said to the woman, "V'yemer ela isha, af ki amar Elokim lo sochlu mikol eitz hagan." Now, why didn't he try to tempt man? Why did he tempt the woman? So I don't want to detain anyone. There's a mixed crowd here, but no, it's
hearsay,
clear.
Hearsay.
It's clear, yeah, because with her it's hearsay.
Because what?
She wasn't told. What to do with the tree,
right.
From Hashem, from God. She was told by Adam, so it's sort of a game of telephone. Really, Adam said, "I was there when Adam was told that by God. You weren't. You weren't around yet." But he's lying to you, right? Now when he says, "You see, the snake," if you, there are many different ways to understand this story. Most rationalists, that will be the Rambam, Ibn Ezra, Radak. You know, most of the Spanish commentaries believe that this snake never spoke, that the conversation is happening in Chava's own head, right? And in fact, some of the commentaries say that there's no snake at all in the story. I find an interesting compromise from Abarbanel. It says there is a snake in the story. The snake could be representative of something. That there is a snake in the story, but that the snake did something that Chava interpreted as permission on her part to eat that tree. What do you think that could possibly be?
He ate it too.
And especially that really fits his opening statement.
He ate
from that tree himself.
He ate. Right.
And did he push her to touch it?
That's Rashi. That's a different one, but I'll get to that in a moment. But the it fits very nicely with the opening statement he makes to her. Not that the snake ever spoke. Snakes don't speak for these commentaries. Right? Not that the donkey ever spoke in Parshas Balak either, by the way, for these same commentaries. But when it says here, you cannot eat from any of the trees in the garden, this is a Bravanel now, that's really Chava talking to herself and saying, wait a second. She's being a very medactic kind of reader. If you look back in chapter 2, when God was announcing to all the creatures of the world what they should eat, he told the beasts of the field, you may eat the herbs and what's on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then he turns to, and he, after turning to man and saying, man, you may eat the herbs and what's on the ground and the fruit of the trees. No fruits were for the snake. And now he's eating a fruit I can't eat? Mm. You get it? When she says, now I'm just going in this direction. I'm about to go in a different direction, but this direction is that what made the conversation turn to an outright lie that says that God says you can't eat from any of these trees. Right? Digression. That's the way the Yetzirah works.
Right.
The Yetzirah doesn't want you to do X when you could do A through W. Right? The Yetzirah tells you you can't do A through X. So I can't do it at all, so why should I even bother? The Yetzirah creates doubts, it creates impossibilities, it creates such barriers that we say, who cares, I can't do any of this anyway. What kind of God would make a garden and not let us eat from any of the trees? But that's not true, Chava. You can eat, but that's how the Yetzirah works. Who was he to tell me what not to do? If I can't eat from that tree, I might as well not be able to eat from any of the trees. This is why Chazal say an amazing, so perfect. It says, Haman min haTorah minayin. Where is Haman hinted at in the Torah? So it says, man, Hamin ha'eitz asher tzivisi levilti achol mimena machalta. And Hamin is spelled, it looks like Haman, right? Haman, did you eat from that tree I told you not to eat from? In other words, he swung from a tree that was supposed to be for someone else. He ate from a tree that was meant for someone else. But what do these two stories have in common? Is that Haman has it all. He's got the queen's attention, he's got the king's soul attention, but he throws it away because of one stupidity of one man who won't bow to him. And Adam and Chava, the same, they have everything. But when you have everything, and there's one thing you can have, it's as if though you have nothing. Maybe no one in this room knows what that feels like. But I'll tell you, someone in Tanakh who does know what that feels like. Does it sound like someone in Tanakh? He has everything. But that only makes him want to have something he knows he shouldn't have.
Well, does Karak like
that?
You're close. Amnon.
Amnon, of course.
Amnon. He can have any woman. Any woman wants to be the wife of the next king. He's the king's oldest son. He's groomed to be the next king. He can have every woman, so he chooses one that he knows he shouldn't have. It's his sister. So whether it's his stepsister, his half-sister, it doesn't matter. But you see, when you have everything, nothing satisfies you. The only thing that will satisfy you is that one tree you know you can't have. Yes?
Is there such an opinion in the Gemara that actually she wasn't his sister either? Because
I said she's a step. He calls her. She's called his sister in the text. It says, and his and Amnon had a beautiful sister.
No, but because...
So I just made reference to that. Either it's were a stepsister about or half-sister.
No, because they, apparently Tamar would have been one of the beautiful... No, her mother was beautiful.
It's Tamar, but it's still his half-sister.
And she was pregnant when... And she went through the conversion process, and apparently they had to convert the baby also.
According to this opinion, Tamar not only could have married Amnon, she could have even married Avshalom.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. But that's a tosfos in the second paragraph in Sanhedrin. But let's tangent of a tangent. But let's stay with what we're saying here. Is that Amnon is behaving like this type of mindset. I can have everything, but when I have everything, if there's any perception of something I can't have, so that's why she speaks about not being able to have any of the trees. Because if I can't have all of them, what does having everyone but one mean to me? Okay? That's how the Yetzirah works, fine. But I'm back to Abravanel. What is this snake doing eating from a tree that even I'm not supposed to eat? And that manifests itself.
Where does she say that she can't eat from any tree?
Tez, look at Pasuk Beis.
She responds to the snake by saying, God says,
for Tamar Isha El Nachash, mi pri eit hagan no chel. We can eat from...
That's from her response to that.
Hmm? We can eat from the trees except for...
I know, but look at... Af ki omara lukim lo tochlu mi kol eit hagan. Read before that.
There's a question.
Huh?
The snake asked the question.
No, she's responding to the Nachash.
Af ki amar elokim lo tochlu mikol eitz hagan.
Af ki amar
elokim
lo tochlu mikol eitz hagan.
All right, now the af is explained by some beforshim that even if this God that you fear told you not to eat from any of them, so what? What does he have to? He's a domineering parent. Just you, come on, you're a child and you can rebel, right? Okay, so. So the snake convinces her that that's how this God became so powerful, by eating from the tree himself. Mm-hmm. And that's why he doesn't want you to have from it, because he wants the power himself. Okay? So... now, when it comes to... Yes, Moshe, a question?
Yeah, I have a question about the cunning part of it. It says... the serpent was cunning beyond any beast of the field, as opposed to the beast of the water or the beast of the air. Is the snake's ability just at the field of all the places in the garden? Seems like it's location oriented.
Well, insofar as it's not likely that a sea creature or a flying creature is going to be involved in this, it just we're just talking about the those who will walk the earth. I don't think that's.
Okay.
I think that's, I don't think that's coming to exclude anything here.
Oh, okay.
Let me just get on with this about what God's take is on about all this. So the snake convinces Chava that A, she won't die if she eats from it, and Adarava, there's much pleasure in eating from this, and. So Camellia said before about that she touched the tree, because she, when describing this command, said in Pasuk Dalid, right, that God told us, Amar Elokim, lo tochlu mimenu velo tigubo, pentumusun. This great power that's above us told us we can't eat it and we can't touch it. Right? Velo tigubo. Now here's a question I pose to you. Who added those words to
Adam,
this command?
Adam.
It must be Adam, because if she added them, she would know that with the snake pushed her intent. She said, "See, you touched it, nothing happened to you." Mm-hmm. So because if she fabricated that addition, that siyag, if you will, then she would know, "Oh, I was just kidding. I just added that as an extra protection." Adam added that to it. Okay? Now Rashi famously tells us what's to be lost when we add too many restrictions. Don't be such a machmir. But Rashi, come on, we do this all the time. It's called a susyag latorah. Mm-hmm. Right? Don't touch the pen. You may come to write with it.
So right.
You put fences. That was her fence around the fruit. So the difference is, though. I don't know. Not touching the fruit sounds like a pretty smart thing. what's the problem with it? What was wrong? Why is Rashi saying this is wrong? We do this all the time.
She didn't have any. She didn't have any rabbinical court decreeing this.
Okay. Well, here is it. So that's the start of it. It's that it's fine to put fences around the Torah as long as you don't stop calling that the Torah. Then you're going to put fences around that, and before you know it, you have 17 fences around, and you don't even know what you're doing or why you're doing it anymore. You know what I'm saying? No, chumras are fine. It's just that it's important to know that the day Moshe died, the day Moshe died, Torah laws ended. There might be interpretations of Torah law and Torah Shabbat Peh, but now the job from the day Yehoshua becomes the leader is to make up takanot or whatever to protect the Torah, right? So to say that God said not to touch it, that's the undoing. Right. In fact, the Rambam says very clearly a few times in the Mishnah Torah, if you call a rabbinic law a Torah law, you are violating the Torah itself. In something called Bal Tosif. Mm-hmm. All right, that's a little far. Okay, so he's telling her, don't worry, you won't die. That's what that power up there is hoping, that you will listen to this, because he knows that if you eat from this, you will gain immortality. Now this, I must tell you, is one of the guiding lights of the ancient Near East.
Mm-hmm.
It's for the human being to do what we feel we need to do to gain immortality. They recognized that there were great powers up there. Those powers crashed the sea and occasionally made tsunamis that took people with them back into the sea. That's a powerful God doing that. There were storms, there were moons that disappeared in the sky, there were total eclipses of the sun. And they had high priests to explain these phenomena to them as part of messages from the gods to us, right? So the people became superstitious about these things. And then sometimes kings, we have a very, very old king, this king lived before Abraham. Hammurabi claimed to be of divine origin. He created himself. He created others. There are laws in the Code of Hammurabi. When we get up to later about when we do law, we're going to see specific laws in the Torah that seem to be written with b'chlalu prat to deal with this law in the Code of Hammurabi.
Huh.
It's hard to deny. I mean, the Code of Hammurabi is written 500 years before Matan Torah.
Hmm.
Okay? I'll just read you, just tell you, paraphrase chapter 60 of Code of Hammurabi. When you live in my land and you plant a tree, the first 5 years of this tree's existence, in fact, 4 years of the tree's existence, all the fruit belong to me. You must bring them to me. Bring the fruits to me. In the fifth year, by my graces, since I created the tree, you may have the fruit afterwards. This sounds just like Orla and Revai. 3 years it's Orla, the fourth year it's Revai, the fifth year it's yours. In the beginning of Parshas Kedoshim. So you're going to say, what, the Torah is just copying from the Code of Hammurabi? No, of course not. The Torah is telling us something, a worthwhile message. That while Hammurabi wants his subjects to think that he is the planter of the tree and the owner of the earth, and by his graces the rest of us get to use it, Hashem wants to say, you know, that sounds like a good idea, but I want you to think that way about me, not about any other human being. Okay? Clear? So what the Torah includes this story to show, you know, yes, there is a penchant for human beings to do something automatic. Didn't I mention last week that if you find something that you think is Avodah Zarah, was once worshipped, you can use it as long as it's not holding something. If it's holding a globe, or it's holding a fleece, or it's holding a sword, or arrows, or thunderbolts, if it's holding something, that means that it is you can't use it. You have to get rid of it. If it's not holding something, you can use it. Why? Because if it's not holding something, it's a sfek sfeika. Maybe this thing was worshipped, maybe it wasn't worshipped. And even if it was worshipped, maybe its worshiper rejected it and was mevatel it and said, nah, this I tried 3 times to do this, and every time I prayed to this thing and it didn't help, I'm getting rid of it. I'm not worshiping this anymore. So we assume that that happened an awful lot in the ancient world. So, but if it's holding on to something, then they only have one suffix. You get it? Because it was certainly worshipped, and they only have one suffix. Maybe it was bottle, maybe it wasn't bottle. Right? Sfex faker. Do you understand what I just mentioned? Sfex faker works in Hilchos Avodah Zarah. Okay? Right? A double suffix. Maybe it wasn't, maybe it was worshipped, maybe it wasn't, and even if it was, maybe it was made bottle. But that's when it's holding something. Why? My nafkamina? Because in all these Avodah Zarahs, that thing it's holding is what gives it its power.
Ah.
Right? So if I can harness that power, i.e. by acquiring something or by eating something, so this is a shortcut to immortality, which is what the ancients were striving for, oh my goodness. Right? To become a saint or to become to get... Now look, we also have things about what's going on in the afterworld, and if we say Kaddish, this helps the soul, and if we believe in this. We believe in something similar, if not in scope, in nature at least, that there are things we do here on earth that affect a larger sphere where the Srafim and Chayos HaKodesh are, right? So where the souls go. And this story I submit to you is here to tell us that there's a natural penchant for these things, but it's important to say the snake and the taninim, they're just another creation. They do not stand up to God. They're not an anti-deity. They don't stand up as co-equals with God in any way. If there's a Tiamat that helps in the creation of the world, it's nothing but the Tahom that's in the deep. And you know what? She's Tohu, right? So the Torah is purposely using terminologies and fanfare and events that come to debunk these things. Okay. All right,
it's also, the snake put forth like, oh yeah, you're going to be so great if you common Yetzer Hara tactics also. And within that conversation, there's like many levels of Yetzer Hara, like, mm-hmm. do this, you want it, you can get it, you'll get immortality, you'll get,
Right, I think that's
the one forbidden thing.
Yes, that's something we see that comes later in Greek philosophy, mm-hmm. the Stoicism of the Greeks, in that you just have the courage to adjust to the fates and your fate, right? The that we'll see in later prophets that Hashem wants us to debunk that theory that you're locked into anything. Adrabah, that's the whole point of our Nevi'im.
Right.
You can change. You seem to be moving in this direction, but you can change. Even the people of Nineveh changed. And it's not even a Jewish thing. It's that human beings have the capacity to change. It's true that the further and further away you move towards certain addictions and certain behavioral patterns, it's almost certain that Amnon is not going to back off. And it's almost certain that Paro is not going to back off.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost certain that Saddam Hussein is not going to get out of those two islands, remember, back on January 15th, 1991. So you know that people move in such a direction that they're not going to. But the our prophets had to debunk us to such a great extent the concept of fatalism and determinism. Mm-hmm. To bring to the ancient Near East the concept of free will. Mm-hmm. Right? So let's continue a little bit here. Right. So once the two of them eat from the tree, their eyes open up. Okay. Now, it's amazing that she eats. And it says, "Vatitain gam leisha ima bayochal." Now, all of a sudden, he's on the story. Did she tell him what this fruit was? Right. So, "Vatitain gam leisha ima bayochal."
Where was he during the conversation?
So I can't make up anything here because Okay, he saw that this, that eating this thing did something for her, because her eyes opened up first. Right? And however she viewed him before, she viewed him differently first, because she saw him after having eaten the fruit before he saw her. So he's, you know, they're both probably still in their unclothed state. And she saw him differently than he saw her so far, because she ate before him. Right? And somehow convinced him that it's worthwhile for you to get what I just got.
Huh.
Right? Yes.
I'm sorry, Rabbi. I know there's many different levels, and you can't. You got to stay on certain levels. You're teaching this shit.
It's okay.
On all of them. And you went into this thing about maybe it was all in her head. There was no snake, but way before that, and I don't know if it's you slipped it. You mentioned it was a giraffe.
Okay, let's move in that direction for just a moment. Moshe, when putting up a bronze snake in the desert, there it's actually called the seraph. And the seraph is usually a flying object in Yeshayahu, in his vision. Seraphim omdim, they have wings, they have six wings, right? So I would just say that. If there is such a correction in the Garden of Eden, I would like to say that those are the Kruvim at the end of the story. The two cherubs at the end that guard the place, so that man doesn't now eat from the. That's a little difficult part. I want to make sure we touch upon this, because at the end, I'm only skipping this because you asked right now, but I want to answer this in that one. Maybe I'll take this next question afterwards. But at the end of the story, where God says, you know, this is, I have to protect this place. Look at Pasuk Chaf Bet at the very end of the story. Chaf Bet. Gimel Chaf Bet on page 8. Mm-hmm. You see it?
Mm-hmm.
It says, V'emar Hashem Elokim, Hein ha'adam haya ke'achad mimenu. Man is getting to be like one of us. Who's us? Right, so, yeah, God's talking to the angels. There are 10 different types of angels up there. All 10 mentioned someplace in the Bible. Okay? They have immortality, right? They exist infinitely by God's will and by God's
wishes. What means that God overall?
So Lodas Tov Vara. So on this Sadyagon, and then the Rambam and the Mor Nevuchim say it doesn't mean just to know between good and evil. God did not. Man knew between good and evil before eating from the tree. Eating from the tree is evil. Not eating, listening is good. Yes. This is Sadyagon adds the word Yesera, which either can mean the ultimate knowledge of good and evil, which might need a lot of heavenly knowledge, or more likely to be the arbiter of good and evil. In other words, and this I think I have a very interesting linguistic or textual basis for this statement. The word Tov appears many times already in the Bible. Not so much Rab, but Tov appears many times. Because at the end of each day of creation, God looks over and he's saying, this is good, this is good, this is good, Tov, 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 Tov Ma'od. So we see God has established that all the good things in the world, I know. I created them. If you can define me with something, and that's really the word God in English is actually related to good. So his omnibenevolence is well attested. The first time someone besides God uses that word, because God also, before she says this, describes something that's lotov. He says, lotov heyosa adam levado. I know what good is, and I know what tov is, and I know what lotov is. But then all of a sudden, he comes this chutzpah. This woman comes into the tree and says, I want a piece of tov. Not just your day tov, they had that. I'm doing the Rambam now. This is the Rambam, the Mor Nevuchim. It says, who is he to why should only he have an idea to say what Tov is? Kitov, 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 Kitov. I want to have a piece of Tov. I want to have a little mind for my own to say what's Tov.
It's Tov Ha'islamahal.
Tovness. Yeah, of course. Yes. Tov Ha'islamahal. Right? Yeah. And then, wait, now I'm really jumping. But this is, I feel I have to end today with this. But it's going to come up again. Yeah. At the end of the parsha, what causes the world to be destroyed is where these powerful men, B'nai Elohim, who are choosing to be like angels, right? They're choosing to be like B'nai Elohim, Nephilim, these giants, they're like so overpowering. They make themselves like gods. And what do? They take these poor little innocent B'nos HaAdam. B'nai Elohim on one side, B'nos HaAdam. And why? Ki Tovos Heina.
Because what?
Ki Tovos Heina. Because they're good. No. That's a strange terminology. I would think Yafos Heina Meinu Yisrael.
Right.
Tafein, I don't know. But Ki Tovos Heina means, you have to read really deep into this. It says, we know what's good. What we want to do is good. So Rashi digs deep into his bag of midrashic information and says, and I really think, and Rashi does this, I have no proof of this, but I think he does it quite often. I can give you a few other examples of where he does something like this. Is that Rashi was using knowledge of what's going on in France and England and Germany at a time, and incorporates it into what this despicable Tovos Heina means. And he quotes a midrash that says that when women got married, they were taken the first night by the official of the town to have the first night with this woman, and then she'd be given back to her husband the next night. How more despicable can you get than that?
Right.
But the Rashi says that was common fare in the ancient Near East. Don't you see and that's why the world is getting destroyed, because it was leading to pandemic and it was leading to all this sexual decay and and it was so common. This was like, if you don't mind my saying it this way, but it was the Torah's Me Too movement. Because the men of that age, the B'nai HaElohim, just thought, of course this is what we have to do. What do you mean? You can't stand up to this. This is what we do. And Hashem says, no, this is why worlds get destroyed. So, but it goes right back to this Tov, this description of Tov. God put us here in order to accept His definition of Tov. That's matzah on Pesach. It's maror on Pesach. It's putting up a mezuzah on your door because it's my will. I told you what the mitzvahs are. Maybe some are arbitrary. Maybe. Try to find reasons for them. Good. Write books. But my definition of what you should do is Tov. And if I tell you not to do it, and you do it, that's Ra. So she wants to be the arbiter of Tov and Ra. And in the ancient world, there is not any one nation, not one even comes close. And this is Yechezkel Kaufman. Did you get the Religion of Israel? Did you get it? Moshe Greenberg, I mentioned it last week. Anyone get it yet? It's you can sometimes get it secondhand. If you want, maybe on Amazon you can get it. The Religion of Israel. I have a few copies.
I tried to look for it. At Westside Judaic, and they said there's very few, and she went on Amazon, whatever, and
it's
starting from $50.
Really?
It's a small
soft cover book.
Really?
In Hebrew, it's called Todot Emunat Yisrael. Nachum Leibowitz quotes it, cites it pretty often. So what Yechezkel Kaufman says is that in the ancient Near East, not one country comes even close to the immense power that nation feels its deity has compared to Israel. Huh. Not one nation that has creation like ours, like Yesh Me'ayin, where there's just one being creating everything, time, space, dimension, out of nothing. There's no such thing. The Greeks were so much against that. And the idea of a human being reaching immortality through ingenuity or through... I mean, look, now this may be a good place to close, because last week we talked a lot about Bereishis. Now I'm still in Bereishis, but we should close with Noach. There are numerous ancient flood stories about characters and heroes who managed to save the entire world from a cataclysmic deluge. And what all these stories, whatever the nature of the hero, whatever the person, what all these stories have in common is a Noah character who manages to build some kind of ark or some kind of vehicle to withstand the wrath of the gods. And the only one has a moral dimension to it. In most of these stories, the human who survives does so in spite of the gods. The gods don't want that person to survive. He outsmarts the gods, and then becomes a god himself in some of them because of this. He gains immortality himself, right? Which is such a crucial point. When Chava looks at the tree and says, and this is Rashi talking, but it's Mamish Tepshut HaShom Mikra, because he says, if you eat from the tree, V'yisem Kelohim, your day tovara. Right? In other words, he didn't say, all right, so Rashi writes, Yotzrei Olamos. Well, you'll know how to create worlds too. Wow, that's pretty big. I wouldn't mind just creating a Ferrari, you know, or maybe a massage chair or something like that. he ate from the tree and came to his power. You can have the same thing. That is such a powerful motif in the ancient world that our story just wants to debunk and get out of here. Yeah, this is crazy. No, you don't do this. You are subject to the will of God, and the world can be a Gan Eden if you submit to it. But, like everyone who ever taught third grade or eighth grade or high school, we know that we human beings are rebellious. We're always looking to get away with something. Right? You know, you ever see they ask these questions on these seminars. How can you make sure your kids don't do drugs? You know what the answer to the question is?
No. Can't.
There's no way a parent can make sure their kids don't do drugs. The only one who can make sure the kids don't do drugs are the kids.
Mm.
Now, let's go to the next step and say, how can you behave in a certain way and show them either unconditional love or seriousness, et cetera, religion, or whatever it is, in a way that will mitigate the chances that they'll do drugs or that they'll know what to say when they're under pressure from their friends? Then the only one who can keep a kid from doing anything is the kid himself. What are you talking about? Unless we're going to tie him up and then and put him in a cave. But you get what I'm saying is that the only one who can keep Adam and Chava or any one of us from doing these things is us. And that's really what these stories are here. Right? These stories are all here to debunk our notions. Our notions are fine because we were raised with these stories, but the notions of the people living at the time that we were reading this for the first time had very, very different ideas about the relationship with the deity and what we can achieve as human beings and what's our faithful our faith and destinies, and these stories undo this. The stories leading into the flood undid a significant amount, but still a lot of work to do on this score, a significant amount of human suffering and exploitation of women at the hands of powerful men.
Mm.
And that would continue. That would continue with the Parsha of Arayos. It would continue with stories of Amnon and Tamar. It would continue with even when a king of Israel might abuse that privilege and take a woman, right? And assume that, you know, if anyone else would call her, but I'm the king, so when I call her, she has to come to my palace. Mm-hmm. So that story also is profoundly has a message that for us we can say, oh, this is really awful, but Chas v'Shalom, it leaves such a klal for the ancient world is that the king allows himself to be rebuked by the prophet over this behavior.
Mm-hmm.
In no other country, it even made its way into the movie with Gregory Peck, when he tells the Bathsheba character, oh, woe to the fact that I'm a king of Israel where the law means everything, because any other king would just make this disappear, and the people wouldn't say boo. Right? So we are the people of the law, and we know that people make mistakes, and David was forgiven because he didn't behave like Shaul, and he admitted his mistake, and then he was able to move on. He spent the rest of his life atoning for it, I'm sure, but he was able to move on. Okay, so that is our message. Yes.
According to Egypt law, Peva is the husband of every woman in Egypt.
Is the husband of every woman? Yes, yes. Potentially, and so is Ahasuerus, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
I'm not joking. That's the law.
So was George Washington.
Is a husband for every woman in Egypt.
Yes, yeah.
It's a claiming to divinity.
I said, I interrupted because I so badly want to warn. Another thing you said is he had eyes for her. And I believe that it was of a sexual nature. And I so badly want to warn about the fallen angel concept.
So that's more of a Christian issue, but...
you said... There was angels there.
Yes, but the idea of the snake being a powerful angelic figure is not in our literature. The snake, the way the story is put out, like the Tanin, is just another animal. According to Abravanel and the rationalist commentaries, which I seem to favor today, if you will, it was the animal that was involved with Chava's imagination, right? What's a punishment? The Talmud says it's not such a terrible punishment. The punishment is that women don't like snakes, but that the punishment is that wherever it goes, it has its meal. A rib steak and steak fries and a nice cold drink is, you know, tastes better than, let's say, dust. But to a snake, they taste the same. Everything tastes like dust to the snake, which is either a curse or a blessing. But to us, it's a curse because the snake never needs anything. The snake has whatever it needs, wherever it goes.
But don't we have a midrash that the Nachash is samech?
That's different. That's different. Now that's back at Rashi. That's a different direction. But yes, in Hanami. But I just want to
still a creation of God.
Let it be known now in the very beginning of this year of study that because this is very academic in nature, this will tend to take the side of the Rambam approaches, the more rationalist approaches to things than the Midrashic and the. I will always mention both, but because this is very academic in nature, where we're comparing things to ancient historical, so we're going to be more rationalist in our approach.
Okay.
Right. Whenever we have minion now.